I look across to the top table and see that it is almost completely deserted apart from Jules, who is sitting very still, apparently lost in thought. Suddenly there's a commotion from the bar tent, raised voices.
Whoa, steady on. What the fuck is your problem, mate? Jesus, calm down.
And then, unmistakably, my husband's voice. Oh God. I get to my feet and hurry towards the bar. There's a press of people, all avidly watching, like children in a playground. I shove my way through to the front as quickly as I can. Charlie is crouched on the floor. Then I realise that his fist is raised and he's half straddling another man, Duncan.
Say that again, Charlie says.
For a moment, I can only stare at him. My husband, geography teacher, father of two, usually such a mild man. I haven't seen this side of him for a very long time. Then I realise I have to act. Charlie, I say, rushing forward. He turns and for a moment he just blinks at me, like he hardly recognises me. He's flushed, trembling with adrenaline. I can smell the booze on his breath.
Charlie, what the hell are you doing?
He seems to come to his senses a little at this. And, thank God, he gets up without too much fuss. Duncan straightens his shirt, muttering under his breath. As Charlie follows me, the crowd parting to let us pass, I can feel all the guests watching silently. Now that my immediate horror has receded, I simply feel mortified.
What on earth was that?
I ask him as we return to the main tent, sit down at the nearest table.
Charlie, what's got into you?
I had enough, he says. There's definitely a slur to his speech, and I can see how much he's drunk by the bitter set of his mouth. He was mouthing off about the stag, and I've had enough.
Charlie, I say, what happened on the stag?
He gives a loud groan, covers his face with his hands.
Tell me, I say, how bad can it be, really?
Charlie's shoulders slump. He seems resigned to telling me, suddenly. He takes a deep breath. There's a long pause. And then, at last, he begins to talk. We got a ferry to this place a couple of hours' ride from Stockholm, made a camp there on an island in the archipelago. It was very, you know, boy's own. Putting up tents, lighting a fire. Someone had bought some steaks and we cooked them over the embers. I didn't know any of the blokes other than Will, but they seemed all right, I suppose. Suddenly it's all tumbling out of him, the booze he's drunk loosening his tongue. They'd all been to Trevelyan's together, he tells me, so there was a lot of boring reminiscing about that. Charlie just sat there and smiled and tried to look interested. He didn't want to drink much, obviously, and they mocked him about that. Then one of them, Pete, Charlie thinks, produced some mushrooms.
You ate mushrooms, Charlie? Magic mushrooms?
I nearly laugh. This doesn't sound at all like my sensible, safety-conscious husband. I'm the one who's up for trying stuff out, who dipped her foot into it a couple of times in my teenage years on the Manchester club scene. Charlie screws up his face. Yeah, well, we were all doing it. When you're in a group of blokes like that, you don't say no, do you? And I didn't go to their posh school, so I was already the odd one out.
But you're 34, I want to say to him.
What would you say to Ben, if his friends were telling him to do something he didn't want to? Then I think of last night, as I downed that drink while they all chanted at me. Even though I didn't want to, knew I didn't actually have to. So, you took magic mushrooms. This is my husband, deputy head, who has a strict zero-tolerance policy of drugs at his school. Oh my God, I say, and I do laugh now. I can't help it. Imagine what the PTA would say about that. Next, Charlie tells me, they all got into the canoes and went to another island. They were jumping in the water, naked. They dared Charlie to swim out to a third tiny island. There were lots of dares like that. And then when he got back, they'd all gone. They had left him there, without his canoe. I had no clothes. It might have been spring, but it's the fucking Arctic Circle, Han. It's freezing at night. I was there for hours before they finally came for me. I was coming down from the mushrooms. I was so cold, I thought I was going to get hypothermia. I thought I was going to die. And when they found me, I was...
What?
I was crying. I was lying on the ground, sobbing like a child. He looks mortified enough to cry now, and my heart goes out to him. I want to give him a hug, like I would Ben, but I'm not sure how it would go down. I know men do stupid stuff on stags, but this sounds targeted, like they were singling Charlie out. That's not right, is it? That's horrible, I say. That's like bullying, Charlie. I mean, it is bullying. Charlie has a fixed, faraway expression. I can't read it. The arrogance of having always assumed I know my husband inside out. We've been together for years, but it has taken less than 24 hours in this strange place to show that assumption up for the illusion it is. I've felt it ever since we made that crossing over here. Charlie has seemed increasingly like a stranger to me. The stag do is one more confirmation of this. The discovery of a horrific experience that he has kept from me, that I now suspect might have changed him in some complex, invisible way. The truth is, I don't think Charlie is quite himself at the moment, or not the self I know. This place has done something to him. To us. It was all his idea, Charlie says. I'm sure of it. Whose idea? Duncan's? No. He's an idiot. A follower. Will. He was the ringleader. You could tell. And Jono too. The others were all acting on instructions. I can't quite imagine Will making the others do that. Anyway, the stags are normally the ones to call the shots, not the groom. Yeah, I can see Jono being behind it, no problem, especially after that stunt just now. He has that slightly wild air about him. Not malicious, but like he might push things too far without really meaning to. Definitely Duncan. But not Will. I think Charlie prefers to hang the blame on Will simply because he doesn't like him. You don't believe me, do you? Charlie says, his expression darkening. You don't think it was Will? Well, I say, if I'm honest, not really, because...
Because you want to screw him, he snarls. Yeah, did you think I hadn't noticed? I saw the way you looked at him last night, Hannah. Even the way you say his name.
He does a horrible little falsetto.
Oh, Will, tell me about that time you got frostbite. Oh, you're so masculine.
The ferocity of his tone is so unexpected that I recoil from him. It's been so long since Charlie's been drunk that I'd forgotten the extent of the transformation. But I'm also reacting to the tiny element of truth in it. A flicker of guilt at the memory of how I found myself responding to Will. But it quickly transforms itself to anger.
Charlie, I hiss. How dare you speak to me like that? Do you realise how offensive you're being? All because he made some effort to make me feel welcome, which is a hell of a lot more than you did.
And then I remember last night, that flirting with Jules, that slinking into our bedroom in the small hours when he definitely hadn't been drinking with the men.
Actually, I say, my voice rising, you haven't got a leg to stand on. That whole horrible charade with you and Jules last night. She's always acting like she has you wrapped around her little finger and you play along. Do you know how it makes me feel?
My voice cracks.
Dear,
I'm caught between anger and tears, the pressure and loneliness of the day catching up with me. Charlie looks slightly chastened. He opens his mouth to speak, but I shake my head.
You've had sex with her, haven't you?
I've never wanted to know before, but now I'm feeling brave enough to ask it. There's a long pause. Charlie puts his head in his hands. Once, he says, voice muffled through his fingers. But ages and ages ago, honestly.
When? When was it? When you were teenagers?
He lifts his head, opens his mouth, as though to speak, then closes it again. His expression. Oh my God. Not when they were teenagers. I feel as though I have been punched in the stomach. But I have to know now. Later, I ask. He sighs, then nods. My throat seems to close up so that it's a struggle to get the words out. Was it when we were together? Charlie folds over into himself, puts his face in his hands again. He lets out a long, low groan.
Han, I'm so sorry. It didn't mean anything, honest. It was so stupid. It was when we hadn't had sex for ages. It was... after I had Ben. I feel sick to my stomach. I'm suddenly certain. He doesn't say anything, and that's all the confirmation I need. Finally, he speaks. You know, we were going through a rough patch. You were, well, you were so down all the time, and I didn't know what to do, how to help.
You mean, when I had borderline postnatal depression? When I was waiting for the stitches to heal? Jesus Christ, Charlie.
I'm so sorry. All the bluster has gone out of him now. I could almost believe he's completely sober. I'm so sorry, Han. Jules had just broken up with her boyfriend she had at the time. We went out for drinks after work. I had too much. We both agreed it was a terrible idea afterwards, that it would never happen again. It didn't mean anything. I mean, I barely remember it. Han, look at me.
I can't look at him. I won't look at him. It's so horrible I can barely begin to think about it clearly. I feel like I'm in shock, like the full hurt of it hasn't sunk in yet. But it throws all that flirting, all that physical closeness, into a new, terrible light. I think of all the times I have felt Jules has purposefully excluded me, cordoning off Charlie for herself. That bitch. So all this time, I say, all this time that you've been telling me you've only ever been friends, that a bit of flirting means nothing, that she's like a sister to you. That's not fucking true, is it? I have no idea what the two of you were doing last night. I don't want to know. But how dare you?
Han, he reaches out a hand, touches my wrist, tentatively.
No, don't touch me. I snatch my arm away, stand up. And you're a state, I say. An embarrassment. Whatever they did to you on the stag, there's no excuse for your behaviour just now. Yeah, maybe it was awful, what they did, but it didn't do you any lasting harm, did it? For Christ's sake, you're a grown man, a father.
I almost add, a husband, but can't bring myself to.
You've got responsibilities, I say. And you know what? I'm sick of looking after you. I don't care. You can sort out your own bloody mess. I turn and stride away.
Jono, the best man. Jono, Will says with a little laugh. The cave walls echo the laugh back at us. I really don't know what you're talking about. All this talk of the past, it isn't good for you. You have to move on. Yeah, I think. But I can't. It's like some part of me got stuck there. As much as I've tried to forget it, it has been there at the centre of me, this toxic thing. I feel like nothing has happened in my life since. Nothing that matters, anyway. And I wonder how Will has been able to carry on living his life without even a backward glance. They said it was a tragic accident, I say. But it wasn't. It was us, Will. It was all our fault. I've been tidying the dorm, Lona said when we came in from rugby practice. I'd told him to do it as I'd run out of other stuff for him to do. But I found these. He held them in his hand as though they might burn him. A stack of GCSE exam papers. He looked at Will. You'd think from Lona's expression that someone had died. I suppose for him, someone had died. His hero. Put them back, Will said, very quiet. You shouldn't have taken them, Lona said, which I thought showed courage, considering we were both about twice his height. He was a pretty brave kid, and decent too, when I think about it, which I try not to. He shook his head. It's cheating. Will turned to me after he'd left the room. You're a fucking idiot, he said. Why'd you get him to tidy it when you knew they were there? He was the one that had stolen them, not me. Though I'm sure now that he'd have let me take the blame if it got out. I remember how he gave a grin then that wasn't really a grin at all. You know what, he said. I think tonight we'll play survival. You couldn't bear it, I say to Will. because you knew you'd get expelled if it got out. And your fucking reputation has always been so important to you. It's always been like that. You take what you want and fuck everyone else if they might get in your way. Even me. Jono, Will says, his tone calm, rational. You've had too much to drink. You don't know what you're saying. If it had been our fault, we wouldn't have got away with it. Would we? It only took the two of us. There were four boys in Loner's dorm that night. A couple of them had got sick and were in the sand. That helped. I felt like maybe one of them stirred when we came in, but we were quick. I felt like an assassin. And it was fucking brilliant. It was fun. I wasn't really thinking. Just adrenaline pumping through me. I shoved a rugby sock into his mouth while Will tied the blindfold so that any noises he made were pretty muffled and quiet. It wasn't hard to carry him. He weighed nothing at all. He struggled a bit. He didn't wet himself, though, like some of the boys did. As I say, he was a pretty brave kid. I thought we'd go into the woods, but Will motioned to the cliffs. I looked at him, not understanding. For one horrible moment, it felt like he might suggest we throw the kid off them. The cliff path, he mouthed at me. Yeah, okay. I was relieved. It took us ages, climbing down the cliff path, with the chalk disintegrating with every step, our feet skidding, and we couldn't even use the handrail hammered into the rock because our hands were full. The kid had stopped struggling. He'd gone very still. I remember I was worried he couldn't breathe, so I went to take the gag out, but Will shook his head. You can breathe through his nose, he said. Maybe it was around then that I started feeling bad. I told myself that was stupid. We'd all been through it, hadn't we? We kept on going. Finally, we were on the beach, down on the wet sand. I couldn't work out how we were going to make this hard. It would be obvious where he was, once he'd got the blindfold off, even without his glasses. It wasn't that far from the school, and anyone could climb up that cliff path, a little kid especially. Boys went down to the beach all the time. But I thought, maybe Will wanted to make it easy for him after all, because of all the stuff he'd done for us, cleaning our boots and tidying our dorm and all of the rest. That seemed fair. You know it, Will, I say. A noise comes up from somewhere deep inside my chest. A sound of pain. I think I might be crying. We should have paid for it. What we did. I remember how Will pointed to the bottom of the cliff path. That was when he produced some laces. Nothing fancy. The laces from a pair of rugby boots. We're going to tie him up, he said. It was easy in the end. Will got me to tie him to the handrail at the bottom of the cliff path. I was pretty good with knots, that sort of thing. Now I got it. That would make it a bit more difficult. He'd have to do a Houdini to get out of there. That was the part that would take the time. Then we left him. For God's sake, Jono, Will says. You heard what they said at the time. It was a terrible accident. You know that isn't true. No, that is the truth. There isn't anything else. I remember waking up the next day and looking out of the window in our dorm and seeing the sea. And that was when I realized. I couldn't believe how stupid we'd been. The tide had come in. Will, I said. Will, I don't think he could have untied himself. The tide. I didn't think. Oh, God, I think he might be... I thought I might throw up. Shut up, Jono, Will said. Nothing happened, okay? First of all, we need to work that out between us, Jono. Otherwise, we're in big trouble. You get that, right? I couldn't believe it was happening. I wanted to go to sleep and wake up and none of it be real. It didn't seem real, something so fucking terrible. All for the sake of a few bits of stolen paper. Okay, Will said. Do you agree? We were in bed. We don't know anything. He jumped so quickly ahead. I hadn't even thought about that stuff, telling someone. But I guess I would have assumed that was what we had to do. That was the right thing, wasn't it? You couldn't keep something like this secret. But I wasn't going to disagree with him. His face kind of scared me. His eyes had changed, like there was no light behind them. I nodded, slowly. I guess I didn't think then about what it would mean later, how it would destroy me. "Say it out loud," Will told me. "Yeah," I said, and my voice came out as a croak. He was dead. He hadn't been able to get himself free. It was a tragic accident. That was what we all got told a week later in assembly after he had been found, washed up further on the beach by the school caretaker. I suppose the ties must have come undone after all, just not in time to save him. You'd have thought there would have been marks anyway. The local police chief was a mate of Will's dad. The two of them would drink together in Will's dad's study. I guess that helped. "I remember his parents," I say to Will now, "coming to the school after. His mum looked like she wanted to die too." I saw her from the dorm upstairs, getting out of her car. She looked up and I had to step out of sight, trembling. I crouch down so I'm level with Will. I grip his shoulders, hard, make him look me in the eye. "We killed him, Will. We killed that boy." He fights me off, throwing his arms out blindly. His fingernails catch my neck, scratching under my collar. It stings. I shove him against the rock with one hand. "Jono," Will says, breathing hard, "you need to get a grip of yourself. You need to shut the fuck up." And that's when I know I've gotten to him. He hardly ever swears. It doesn't fit with his golden boy image, I guess. "Did you know?" I ask him. "You did know, didn't you?" "Did I know what? I don't know what you're talking about. For Christ's sake, Jono, untie me. This has gone on long enough." "Did you know that the tide would come in?" "I don't know what you're talking about, Jono. You're not making sense. I knew it last night, mate, and in the speech. You've been drinking too much. Do you have a problem? Look, I'm your friend. There are ways to get help. I can help you. But stop with this fantasizing." I push my hair out of my eyes. Even though it's cold, I feel the sweat come away on my fingers. "I was a fucking idiot. I've always been the slow one. I know that. I'm not saying it's an excuse. I was the one who tied him up, yeah, when you told me to. But I didn't think about the tide. I didn't think about it until the next morning when it was too late." "Jono," Will hisses like he's scared someone might come. It only makes me want to be louder. "All this time," I say, "all this time I've wondered that. And I gave you the benefit of the doubt. I thought, yeah, Will could be a dick at school at times, but we all were. You had to be, to survive in that place." It made us into animals. I think of the kid, how he was an example of what happened if you weren't. If you were too good, too honest, if you didn't understand the rules. "But," I say, "I thought, Will's not evil. He wouldn't kill a kid. Not over some stolen exam papers. Even if it meant he might get expelled." "I didn't kill him," Will says. "No one killed him. The water killed him. The game killed him, maybe. But not us. It's not our fault he didn't get away." "Yeah," I say. "Yeah, that's what I've told myself all these years. I've repeated the story you created. It was the game." "But we were the game, Will. He thought we were his mates. He trusted us." "Jono!" Now he's angry. He leans forward. "Get a fucking grip!" I'm not going to let you ruin all of this for me. Because you've got some regrets about the past, because your life is a mess and you don't have anything to lose. A little kid like him, he wouldn't ever have survived in the real world. He was a runt. If it wasn't us, it would have been something else. The term ended early because of the death. Everyone turned their attention to the upcoming summer holidays, and it seemed like the kid had never existed. I suppose he barely had for the rest of the school. He was a first year, a non-entity. Except there was a grass, one pupil who sneaked on us. I was always sure it was Lona's fat little friend. He said he'd seen us come into the dorm room, tie Lona up. It didn't get very far. Will's dad was headmaster, of course. He was a dick most of the time, more to Will than anyone else. But for this, he had Will's back and mine too. And we had each other's. All these years we've stuck together, bound by memories, by the dark shit we went through together, the thing we did. I thought he felt the same way about it too, that we needed each other. But what the TV stuff shows is that all that time he wanted out of our friendship. I'm too much of a liability. He wanted to distance himself from me. No wonder he looked so fucking uncomfortable when I told him I'd be his best man. Jono, Will says, think about my dad. You know what he's like. That's why I was desperate to try and get those grades. I had to do it. And if he'd found out the truth, how I hid those papers, he would have killed me. So I wanted to scare the kid. Don't you dare, I say. Don't you start feeling sorry for yourself. Do you know how many free passes you've been given? Because of how you look, how you managed to convince people that you're this great bloke. It's only made me angrier, his self-pity. I'm going to tell them, I say. I can't deal with it any longer. I'm going to tell them all. You wouldn't dare, Will says, his voice changed now, low and hard. You'd ruin our lives. Your life too. Ha! I say. It already ruined my life. It's been destroying me ever since that morning, when you told me to keep my mouth shut. I never would have stayed silent in the first place if it weren't for you. Since that boy died, there hasn't been a day when I haven't thought about it. Felt like I should have told someone. But you? Oh no, it hasn't affected you in any way, has it? You've just gone on like you always have. No consequences. Well, you know what? I think it's about time that there are some. It'd be a relief, as far as I'm concerned. I'd only be doing what we should have done years ago. There's a sound in the cave then, a woman's voice. Hello? Both of us freeze. Will? It's the wedding planner. Are you in here? She appears around the bend of the rock wall. Oh, hello, Jono. Will, I've been sent to find you. The other ushers told me that they left you in here. She sounds totally calm and professional, even though we're all standing in a bloody great cave and one of us is slumped on the ground, tied up and blindfolded. It's been nearly half an hour, so Julia wanted me to come and, well, rescue you. I should warn you that she's not... She looks like she's trying to find a way to put it delicately. She's not as delighted as she might be by this. And the band are about to start. She waits as I untie Will and help him up, watching over us like a schoolteacher. Then we follow her out of the cave. I can't help wondering if she heard or saw anything, or what I would have done if she hadn't interrupted us.
Aoife, the wedding planner. In the marquee, the celebrations have moved into another gear. The guests have drunk the champagne dry. Now they are moving on to the stronger stuff, cocktails and shots at the temporary bar. They are high on the freedom of the night. In the toilets in the folly, refreshing the hand towels, I find telltale spills of fine white powder on the floor, scattered across the slate sinks around. I'm not surprised. I've seen guests wiping their noses furtively as they return to the marquee. They have behaved themselves for the rest of the day, this lot. They have travelled long distances to be here. They have come bearing gifts. They have dressed themselves appropriately and sat through a ceremony and listened to the speeches and worn the proper expressions and said the right things. But they're adults who have briefly left their responsibilities behind. They're like children without their parents present. Now this part of the day is theirs for the taking. Even as the bride and groom wait to begin their first dance, they press forward, ready to make the dance floor their own. An hour or so earlier, on a trip back to the Folly, I heard a strange noise upstairs. The rest of the building was barricaded off, of course, but there are only so many measures you can take to stop drunk people going where they want. I went up to inspect, pushed open the door of the bride and groom's bedroom, and found not the happily married couple, but another man and woman, bent low over the bed. At my intrusion, they scrambled to cover themselves, she yanking down her skirts red-faced, he covering his bobbing erection with his own top hat. Only a while later, I saw them both returning innocently to different corners of the marquee. What particularly interested me about this was that they both appeared to be wearing wedding bands. And yet, and I've probably memorised the table plan as well as Julia herself now, I happen to know that all husbands and wives are seated opposite each other. They weren't worried about me, though, not really. Their initial panic at my entrance gave way to a kind of giggly relief. They know I won't expose their secret. Besides, I wasn't particularly surprised. I've seen much of the same before. This extremity of behaviour is very much par for the course. There are always secrets around the fringes of a wedding. I hear the things said in confidence, the bitchy remarks, the gossip. I heard some of the best man's words in the cave. This is the thing about organising a wedding. I can put together a perfect day, as long as the guests play along, remember to stay within certain bounds. But if they don't, the repercussions can last far longer than 24 hours. No one is capable of controlling that sort of fallout.
Jules, the bride. The band have begun to play. Will, who returned to the marquee looking slightly unkempt, takes my hand as we step onto the laminate floor. I realise I'm holding his hand hard enough to hurt, probably, and I tell myself to loosen my grip. But I'm incensed by the interruption to the evening caused by the ushers and their stupid prank. The guests around us, whooping, hollering. Their faces are flushed and sweaty, their teeth bared, their eyes wide. They're drunk, and more. They press forward, leaning in, and the space suddenly feels too small. They're so close that I can smell them. Perfume and cologne. The sour, yeasty smell of Guinness and champagne. Body odour, booze-soured breath. I smile at them all because that is what I am meant to do. I smile so much that there is a dull ache somewhere beneath my ears and my whole jaw feels like an overstretched piece of elastic. I hope I'm giving an impression of having a good time. I've drunk a lot, but it hasn't had any discernible effect other than making me more wary, more jittery. Since that speech, I've been feeling a mounting unease. I look around me. Everyone else is having a great time. Their inhibitions truly thrown off now. To them, the train wreck of a speech is probably a mere footnote to the day, an amusing anecdote. Will and I turn one way, then the other. He spins me away from him and back again. The guests shout their appreciation of these modest moves. We didn't go to dance lessons, because that would be unspeakably naff. But Will is a naturally good dancer. Except that a couple of times he treads on the train of my dress. I have to yank it away from under his feet before I trip. It's unlike him to be so graceless. He seems distracted. What on earth was all of that? I ask, when I'm drawn to his chest. I whisper it as though I am whispering a sweet nothing into his ear. Oh, It was stupid, Will says. Boys being boys. Messing around, you know. A little left over from the stag, maybe. He smiles, but he doesn't look quite himself. He downed two large glasses of wine when he returned to the marquee, one after the other. He shrugs. Jono's idea of a joke. The seaweed was supposedly a little joke last night, I say, and that wasn't very bloody funny. And now this, and that speech, what did he mean by all of that? What was all that about the past? About keeping secrets from each other? What secrets did he mean? Oh, Will says. I don't know, Jules. It's only Jono messing around. It's nothing. We turn a slow circle about the floor. I have an impression of beaming faces, hands clapping. But it didn't sound like nothing, I say. It sounded very much like something. Will, what sort of hold does he have over you? Oh, for God's sake, Jules, he says sharply. I said it's nothing. Drop it. Please. I stare at him. It's not the words themselves so much as the way he said them. That and the way he has tightened his hold on my arm. It feels like as strong a corroboration as one could ask for that whatever it is, it's very much not nothing. You're hurting me, I say, pulling my arm out of his grip. He is immediately contrite. Jules, look. I'm sorry. His voice is totally different now. Any hint of hostility immediately gone. I didn't mean to snap at you. Look, it's been a long day. A wonderful day, of course, but a long one. Forgive me. And he gives me a smile. The same smile I haven't been able to resist since I saw it that night at the V&A Museum. And yet it doesn't have the same effect it normally does. If anything, it makes me feel more uneasy. Because of the speed of the change. It's as though he's pulled on a mask. We're a married couple now, I say. We are meant to be able to share things with one another. To confide in each other. Will spins me away under his arm and towards him again. The crowd cheer this flourish. Then, when we're facing one another once more, he takes a deep breath. Look, he says. Jono has got this bee in his bonnet about this thing that he says happened in the past, when we were young. He's obsessed by it, but he's a fantasist. I felt sorry for him all these years. That's where I went wrong, feeling I should pander to him, because my life has worked out and his hasn't. Now he's envious of everything I have, we have. He thinks that I owe him. Oh, for God's sake, I say. What could you possibly owe him? He's the one that's clearly been hanging on your coattails for too long. He doesn't answer this. Instead, he pulls me close. As the song comes to its crescendo, a cheer goes up from the crowd, but they sound suddenly far away. After tonight, that's it, Will says firmly, into my hair. I'll cut him from my life. Our life. I promise. I'm done with him. Trust me. I'll sort it out.
Hannah, the plus one. I've wandered into the dance tent. The first dance is over, thank God, and all the guests who were watching have swarmed in to fill the space. I'm not sure what I want to find in here exactly. Some distraction, I suppose, from the churn of thoughts in my head. Charlie and Jules. It's too painful to think about. It feels as though every single guest is crammed in here, a hot press of bodies. The band's vocalist takes to the mic. Are you ready to dance, girls and boys? They begin to play a frenzied rhythm. Four fiddles, a wild foot-tapping tune. Bodies are crashing around as everyone attempts, unsuccessfully, drunkenly, to do his or her version of an Irish jig. I see Will grab Olivia out of the crowd. Time for the groom to claim his dance with the bridesmaid. But they seem oddly out of step as they careen onto the dance floor, as though one of them is resisting the other. Olivia's expression gives me pause. She looks trapped. There was this bit in the speech. I thought that before. What was it? It had struck me as oddly familiar. I grope about in my memory for it, trying to focus. The V&A Museum. That was it. I remember her telling me last night about how she brought Stephen there, to a party, held by Jules. And everything goes still as it occurs to me. But that's completely crazy. It can't be. It wouldn't make any sense. It must be a weird coincidence. Hey, a guy says as I push past him. What's the hurry? Oh, I say, glancing vaguely in his direction. Sorry, I was a bit distracted. Well, maybe a dance will help with that. He grins. I look at him more closely. He's pretty attractive. Tall, black-haired, a dimple forming in one cheek when he smiles. And before I can say anything, he takes hold of my hand and gives me a gentle tug towards him, onto the laminate of the dance floor. I don't resist. I saw you earlier, he shouts, over the music. In the church, sitting on your own. And I thought, she looks worth getting to know. That grin again. Oh, he thinks I'm single, here by myself. He can't have caught that scene with Charlie in the bar. Lewis, he shouts now, pointing to his chest. Hannah. Maybe I should explain that I'm here with my husband, but I don't want to think about Charlie right now. And holding this flattering new image of myself through his eyes, not the badly dressed imposter I thought I was, but someone attractive, mysterious, I decide not to say anything. I allow myself to begin to move in time with him, to the music. I allow him to move a little nearer, his eyes on mine. Perhaps I move closer too. Close enough that I can smell his sweat, but clean sweat, a good smell. There's a stirring in the pit of my stomach, a little sting of want.
Now, the wedding night. Someone else out there. The thought has them spooking at shadows, cringing away from shapes in the blackness, which seem to loom up at them and then reveal themselves to be nothing more than tricks of the eye. They move in a tight, close pack, afraid of losing another of their number. Pete is still missing. They seem to feel the prickle of unknown eyes upon them. They feel clumsier now, more exposed. They trip and stumble over the uneven ground, over hidden tussocks of heather. They try not to think about Pete. They can't afford to. They have to look out for themselves. Every so often they shout out to one another, for reassurance more than anything else, their voices like another light held against the night, uncharacteristically caring.
All right there, Angus. Yeah. You okay, Femi?
It helps them to keep going. It helps them forget about their mounting fear.
Jesus, what's that?
Femi sweeps his torch in a wide arc. It illuminates an upright form, rising palely out of the shadows, nearly as tall as a man. And then several similar shapes, some smaller too.
It's the graveyard,
Angus calls softly. They gaze at the Celtic crosses, the crumbling stone forms, an eerie, silent army.
Christ!
Duncan shouts.
I thought it was a person!
For a moment, they all thought it. The round shape and thin, upright base conspired briefly to seem human. Even now, as they retreat somewhat gingerly, it is hard to shake the feeling of being watched reproachfully by the many sentinel forms. They continue for a time in a new direction.
Do you hear that? Angus shouts. I think we've got too close to the sea now.
They stop. Somewhere near at hand, they are vaguely aware of the crash of water against rock. They can feel the ground shuddering beneath their feet at the impact of it.
Okay, right, Femi thinks. The graveyard's behind us, the sea's here. So I think we need to go that way.
They begin to creep away from the sound of the crashing surf.
Hey, there's something there.
Instantly, they all stop where they are.
What did you say, Angus? I said there's something there. Look.
They hold out their torches. The beams they cast tremble on the ground. They're bracing themselves to find a grisly sight. They're surprised and rather relieved when the torchlight reflects brightly off the hard gleam of metal.
It's a... What is it?
Femi, bravest among them, steps forward and picks it up. Turning to them, shielding his eyes from the glare, he lifts it so they can all see. They recognize the object immediately. Although it is mangled out of shape, the metal twisted and broken. It is a gold crown.
Earlier that day, Olivia, the bridesmaid. I wander round the corners of the marquee. I move between the tables. I pick up half-full glasses, the remains of people's drinks, and down them. I want to get as drunk as possible. I pulled away from Will as quickly as I could after he grabbed me for that dance. It made me feel sick being so close to him, feeling his body pressed up against me, thinking of the things I've done with him, the things he got me to do, the horrible secret between us. It was like he was getting off on it. Right at the end, he whispered in my ear, "That crazy stunt you pulled earlier, that's the end of it, okay? No more. Do you hear me? No more." No one seems to notice me as I go about minesweeping their discarded drinks. They're all pretty wasted by now, and besides, they've abandoned the tables for the dance floor. It's absolutely crammed in there. There are all these 30-somethings slut-dropping and grinding on each other as though they're in some shit naughties club dancing to 50 Cent, not a marquee on a deserted island with some guys playing fiddles. The old me might have found it funny. I could imagine texting my mates, giving them a live running commentary on the absolute cringe fest going on in front of me. A few of the waiters are watching everyone from the corners of the marquee, sort of hovering on the edges of things. Some of them are about my age, younger. They all hate us, it's so obvious, and I'm not surprised. I feel like I hate them too, especially the men. I've been touched on the shoulder, on the hip, and on the bum tonight by some of the blokes here, Will and Jules's so-called friends. Hands grabbing, stroking, squeezing, cupping, out of sight of wives and girlfriends, as I'm a piece of meat. I'm sick of it. The last time it happened, I turned around and gave the guy such a poisonous stare that he actually backed away from me, making a stupid, wide-eyed face and holding his hands up in the air, all mock innocent. If it happens again, I feel like I might really lose it. I drink some more. The taste in my mouth is foul, sour and stale. I need to drink until I don't care about that sort of thing, until I can't taste or feel any more. And then I'm seized by my cousin Beth and dragged towards the dance tent. Other than earlier, outside the church, I haven't seen Beth since last year at my aunt's birthday. She's wearing a ton of makeup, but underneath you can see she's still a child, her face round and soft, her eyes wide. I want to tell her to wipe off the lipstick and eyeliner, to stay in that safe childhood space for a while longer. On the dance floor, surrounded by all these bodies moving and shoving, the room begins to spin. It's like all the stuff I've drunk has caught up with me in one big rush. And then I trip, maybe over someone's foot, or maybe it's my own stupid too high shoes. I go down hard, with a crack that I hear a long time before I feel it. I think I've hit my head. Through the fog, I hear Beth speaking to someone nearby. She's really drunk, I think. Oh my God. Get Jules, someone says, or her mum. Can't see Jules anywhere. Oh, look, here's Will. Will, she's pretty drunk. Can you help? I don't know what to do. He comes towards me, smiling, Oh, Olivia, what happened? He reaches out a hand to me. Come on, let's get you up. No, I say. I bat his hand away. Fuck off. Come on, Will says, his voice so kind, so gentle. I feel him lifting me up, and it doesn't seem like there's much point in struggling. Let's get you some air. He puts his hands on my shoulders. Get your hands off me. I try to fight my way out of his grip. I hear a murmur from the people watching us. I'm the difficult one. I bet that's what they're saying to each other. I'm the crazy one. An embarrassment. Outside the marquee, the wind hits us full force, so hard it nearly knocks me over. This way, Will says. It's more sheltered round here. I feel too tired and drunk to resist all of a sudden. I let him march me round the other side of the marquee, towards where the land gives way to the sea. I can see the lights of the mainland in the distance like a trail of spilled glitter in the blackness. They go in and out of focus, pin sharp, then fuzzy, like I'm seeing them through water. Now, for the first time in a long time, it's just the two of us. Me and him.
Jules, the bride. My new husband seems to have disappeared. Has anyone seen Will? I ask my guests. They shrug, shake their heads. I feel like I've lost any control I might have had over them. They've apparently forgotten that they're here for my big day. Earlier they were circling around me until it almost got unbearable, coming forward with their compliments and well wishes like courtiers before their queen. Now they seem indifferent to me. I suppose this is their opportunity for a little hedonism, a return to the freedom they enjoyed at university or in their early 20s, before they were weighed down with kids or demanding jobs. Tonight is about them, catching up with their mates, flirting with the ones who got away. I could get angry, but there's no point, I decide. I've got more important things to be concerning myself with. Will. The longer I look for him, the more my sense of unease grows. I saw him, someone pipes up. I see it's my little cousin, Beth. He was with Olivia. She was a bit drunk. Oh yeah, Olivia, another cousin chimes in. They went towards the entrance. He thought she should get some air. Olivia, making a spectacle of herself yet again. But when I go outside, there's no sign of them. The only people hanging around in the entrance of the marquee are a group of smokers, friends from university. They turn towards me and say all the things you're meant to say about how wonderful I look, what a magical ceremony it was. I cut them off. Have you seen Olivia? Or Will? They gesture vaguely around the side of the marquee, towards the sea. But why on earth would Will and Olivia go out there? The weather has started to turn now and it's dark, the moonlight too dim to see by. The wind screams about the marquee and around me when I step into the brunt of it. Remembering the near-drowning scene earlier, I feel my stomach pitch with dread. Olivia couldn't have done something stupid, could she? I finally catch sight of their faint outlines beyond the main spill of light from the marquee towards the sea. But some intuition beyond naming stops me from calling out to them. I realise that they're very close to one another. In the near dark, the two shapes seem to blur together. For a horrible moment, I think, but no, they must be talking. And yet, it doesn't make sense. I'm not sure I've ever seen my sister and Will speak to one another, beyond polite conversation at least. I mean, they barely know each other. They've met precisely once before, and yet they seem to have a great deal to say to one another. What on earth can they be talking about? Why come all the way round here, away from the sight of the other guests? I begin to move, silent as a cat burglar, edging forward into the growing darkness.
Olivia. The bridesmaid. I'm going to tell her, I say. It's an effort to get the words out, but I'm determined to do it. I'm going to tell her about us. I'm thinking of what Hannah said earlier. It's always better to get it out in the open, even if it seems shameful, even if you feel like people will judge you for it. He clamps a hand over my mouth. It's a shock, so sudden. I can smell his cologne. I remember smelling that cologne on my skin afterwards, thinking how delicious it was, how grown up. Now it makes me want to vomit. Oh no, Olivia, Will says. His voice is still almost kind, gentle, which only makes it worse. I don't think you will, actually. And you know why? You won't do it because you would be destroying your sister's happiness. This is her wedding day, you silly little girl. Jules is too special to you for you to do that to her. And for what purpose? It's not like anything is going to happen between us now. There's a burst of chatter from the other side of the marquee, and perhaps he's worried someone is going to see us like this because he takes his hand away from my mouth. I know that, I say. That's not what I mean. That's not what I want. He raises his eyebrows, like he isn't sure whether he believes me. Well, what do you want, Olivia? Not to feel so awful any longer, I think. To get rid of this horrible secret I've been carrying around. But I don't answer. So he goes on. I get it. You want to lash out at me. I will be the first to admit I haven't behaved impeccably in all of this. I should have broken it off with you properly. I should perhaps have been more transparent. I never meant to hurt anyone. And can I tell you what I honestly think, Olivia? He seems to be waiting for a reply, so I nod my head. I think that if you were going to do it, you would have done it by now. I shake my head, but he's right. I have had so much time to do it, really, to tell Jules the truth. So many times I have lain in bed in the early hours of the morning and thought about how I'd get Jules on her own, suggest lunch or coffee. But I never did it. I was too chicken. I avoided her instead, like I avoided going to the shop to try on my bridesmaid dress. It was easier to hide, to pretend it wasn't happening. I've thought about what I would do in this situation if I were Jules or Mum. How I would have made a big display, probably the first time I saw him, embarrassed him in front of everyone at the engagement drinks. But I'm not strong like them. Not confident. So I tried with the note. I printed it out and dropped it through Jules's letterbox. Will Slater is not the man you think he is. He is a cheat and a liar. Don't marry him. I thought it might at least make her question him, make her think. I wanted to seed a tiny bit of doubt in her mind. It was pathetic, I can see that now. Maybe Jules didn't even get it. Maybe Will saw it first, or it got swept up with a load of flyers and binned. And even if she did see it, I should have realised Jules isn't the sort of person to be bothered about a note. Jules isn't a warrior. You don't want to destroy your sister's life, do you? Will says now. You couldn't do it to her. It's true. Even though at times I feel like I hate her, I love her more. She'll always be my big sister, and this would ruin things between us forever. He has such confidence in his own story. My own version of it is all falling apart, and I suppose he's right in saying that he didn't lie, not really. He just didn't tell the truth. I don't seem to be able to hold on to my anger anymore. The bright, burning energy of it. I can feel it slipping away from me, leaving in its place something worse, a kind of nothingness. And then, suddenly I think of Jules, the smile on her face as she stood next to him in the chapel, not having a clue about who he really is. Jules never lets anyone make a fool of her, but he has. I feel angry for her in a way I haven't been able to for myself. I've kept your texts, I tell him. I can show them to her. It's the last thing I have over him, the last bit of power I hold. I hold my phone out in front of him to emphasize it. I should see it coming. But he's been speaking so softly, so gently, that somehow I don't. His arm darts out, he grabs my wrist in midair, he grabs my other wrist too, and in one quick motion he's got my phone off me. Before I can even work out what he's doing, he's hurled it far away from us into the dark water. It makes a tiny plop as it enters. "There'll be backups," I say, even though I'm not sure how I'd find them. "Oh, yes," he sneers. "You want to mess people's lives up, Olivia, because you should know that I have some photos on my phone." "Stop," I say. The thought of Jules, of anyone seeing me like that. I felt so uncomfortable when he was taking them. But he was so good at asking for them, telling me how sexy I looked while I was performing for him, how much it would turn him on. And I was worried that not doing them would make me look like a prude, a child. And he wasn't in them at all, not his face, not his voice. He could claim I sent them to him, I realise, that I had shot them myself. He could deny it all. His face is very near to mine now. For a crazy moment, I think he might be about to kiss me. And even though I hate myself for it, a tiny part of me wants him to. Part of me wants him. And that makes me sick. He's still got a hold of my other wrist. It hurts. I make a sound and try to pull away, but he only grips me harder, his fingers digging into my flesh. He's strong, so much stronger than me. I realised that earlier when he carried me out of the water, looking like the big hero, playing to the crowd. I think of my little razor blade, but it's in my beaded bag somewhere in the marquee. Will gives me a yank forward and I trip over my feet. My shoe comes off. It is only now that I realise it's not all that far to the cliff edge, and he's pulling me towards it. I can see all the water out there, glossy black in the moonlight. But he wouldn't, would he?
Now, the wedding night. The ushers stare at the mangled gold crown in Femi's hand. It seemed so out of place where they found it, sitting on the black earth in the midst of the storm, that it takes all of them a few minutes to work out where they have seen it before. "It's Jules's crown," Angus says. "Shit," Femi says. "Of course it is." Each wonders silently what violence it might have taken to so brutally deform the metal. "Did you see her face?" Angus asks. "Jules, before she cut the cake. She looked really angry, I thought. Or maybe really frightened." "Did anyone see her in the marquee?" Femi asks. "After the lights came on." Angus quails. "But surely you can't think... You don't mean you think something really bad could have happened to her?" "Fuck." Duncan lets out a hiss of breath. "I'm not saying that exactly," Femi answers. "I'm only saying, does anyone remember seeing her?" There's a long silence. "I can't." "No, Dunk. Neither can I." They look about them in the darkness, eyes straining for any movement, ears pricked for any sound, breath catching in their throats. "Oh God! Look! There's something else over there!" Angus bends to retrieve the object. They all see how his hand trembles as he lifts it to the light, but none of them mock him for his fear this time. They are all afraid now. It's a shoe. A single caught in a pale grey silk, a jewelled buckle on the toe.
Several hours earlier, Hannah, the plus one. This guy, Lewis, is a great dancer. The band are whipping the guests into a frenzy, forcing us closer together as bodies careen around us, and I find myself thinking about how bloody stressful and lonely my whole day has been. Charlie's largely responsible for that. I don't want to think about him right now, though. I'm too angry with him, too sad. Besides, when was the last time I abandoned myself to some music? When was the last time I had a really good dance? When was the last time I felt this desired, this bloody sexy?
It feels like I lost that part of myself somewhere along the way. For these few hours, I'm going to enjoy having it back. I put my hands above my head. I swing my hair, feel it brush the bare skin of my shoulders. I feel Lewis watching me. I find the rhythm of the music with my hips. I was always a good dancer. Those years of practice in Manchester clubs in my teens, raving to all the latest anthems from Ibiza. I'd forgotten how much in tune it makes me feel with my own body, how much it turns me on. And I can see how good I look reflected in Lewis's approving expression, his gaze only leaving mine to travel down the length of my body as I move. The music slows. Lewis pulls me closer. His hands are on my waist and I can feel his heartbeat through his shirt, the heat of his chest beneath the fabric. I can smell his skin. His lips are inches away from mine, and I'm becoming aware, now our bodies are touching, that he's hard, pressing against me. I pull away a little, try to put a few centimetres of space between us. I need to clear my head. "You know what?" I say. My voice has a tremor in it. "I think I'm going to go and get a drink." "Sure,"